Science can't explain everything. Just because you can't see me doesn't mean I'm not here.
Thank you for joining me, everyone, and welcome to Paranormal Encounters podcast series. My name is Dr. Kelly Renee Schutz. I am the host and the producer of this show. Sit back, grab yourself some popcorn, and let's get started.
Be careful what you whisper.
Yes, indeed, everyone. Let's get started here. We have an interesting guest with us tonight, Miranda Young, who is known as the Ghost Biker Explorations Rider Chick. She is in the house. And boy, did we have an interesting show for you. So as they say, stay tuned.
Whether you're listening at home, at work, or anywhere, thanks for making Para-X part of your day. Your source for everything paranormal. Para-X.
Sit back, everyone, because my guest, Miranda Young, is going to take us all for a ride. The ghost biker Miranda Young grew up in the Appalachian Mountains of East Tennessee in the very rural town of Robbins. Miranda holds a bachelor's degree in mass communications, along with the emphasis in journalism and advertising. Her professional background includes 21 years as a director in marketing, graphic design, and public relations. She is also a professional photographer and artist, specializing in drawing historic buildings and monuments. Miranda is also the founder, host, and producer, and marketing executive behind Ghost Biker Explorations, which is a world-recognized web series that highlights her travels on her motorcycle to historic and haunted locations around the country. Miranda has been featured in numerous magazines and local newspapers, and she has been a guest speaker at events and on podcasts, as well as radio shows across the country. Ghost Biker Explorations is also a popular series as seen on MIXTV web TV platform. In 2021, Miranda co-founded the company History, Highways, and Haunts, LLC, and co-owns the historic Scott County Jail, True Crime Museum, and Paranormal Research Center in Huntsville, Tennessee. Miranda also contributes additional time to doing historic Rugby After Dark tours and investigations in Rugby, Tennessee. We had a lot to talk about this evening, so sit back and put those biker boots on, because Miranda and I will definitely be taking all of us for a ride. Please welcome to the show this evening, Miranda Young. Well, good evening, Miranda, and thank you so much for being on the show today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, real exciting gal. Did you not like that introduction or what? We all have different time frames when things happen to us or we become interested in certain aspects of our world. So go back to the earliest time you remember and tell us where maybe some of your interests in either the paranormal or extraterrestrial or anything or cryptids started for you.
So for me, like a lot of paranormal investigators, I've been interested since I was a child. But for me, it really comes more from the storytelling aspect of things. I grew up next door to my grandma, and she really instilled the importance of storytelling. And so I would spend about every evening sitting on her porch, listening to her tell stories about growing up in the Appalachian Mountains and the different, as we call it around here, we call them haints and boogers, which would essentially be haunts and cryptids. Mm-hmm. And so she shared a lot of those stories with me of experiences she's had, but also just folklore from the area. And so through that, I found that I would spend as much time as I could either in the libraries or talking to different family members or different people from the region, listening to their stories and really just soaking in as much as I could. My dad, he also, we would spend the weekends going, driving on back roads, and he would share stories about the different areas of the community. And I like to call it the ghosts of the past, and how, you know, how the towns used to be and buildings that were in certain areas. And so he would really share of how things had changed. So that's really where I fell in love with the paranormal. I never really had some big grand experience. I didn't grow up in a haunted house or anything like that. It was really just taking those stories and sharing them so that they could live on when these older generations passed on. And so I didn't essentially start investigating or really getting into let me just kind of jump back. I did go to a lot of different cemeteries and places like that, because here in East Tennessee, they're everywhere, especially in these mountain communities. But I didn't actually investigate locations until probably just under 15 years ago when I started with a team.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. And a lot of people that fall into this, a lot of times they might have had something they couldn't explain, or maybe they lived in an older house or even a newer house, or maybe their house was over a cemetery. It just depends. You know, people have a lot of questions regarding all this. And I need to premise something before we go on here, because I know viewers are going to question this, and I don't need to get a lot of email based on this, but Miranda does have behind her, near that door, there is a bug that is flying around. And so don't misinterpret that as anything else. Although she is in a haunted jail, so that doesn't mean we might not still have a visitor tonight. But if you see something small flying around and it's shiny, that's, chances are very likely what you are seeing is a bug. But we'll let you know. I mean, if I can see something, I'm going to point it out. So that's interesting that your grandmother would talk about these stories. Did she have experiences that that she shared with you, or why was she so intrigued by these stories?
Well, you know, here in the Appalachian Mountains, especially here in East Tennessee, you know, that it's just one of those things. It's so steeped in tradition. And so she really based her life around a lot of these traditions and these superstitions and the folklore. And, you know, she did tell one story that I remember in particular was where she said that she did see her uncle who had passed on, and he actually came through the house. Oh. She believed that he was telling her and her family goodbye. At the time, she didn't know that he had passed. And so he came through the house. He seemed like his regular old self, ended up telling her, you know, I will see you soon, and walked on through the house. Well, come to find out, a little bit later that afternoon, my grandmother found out that her uncle had actually since passed away, and that there was no way he could be in the house, because at the time that he had passed would have been the time that she had seen him in the home. And so there were several other members of the family that did see him in there. And so, you know, she would share stories like that, that, you know, she believed that she had been visited, or other instances, because they were in a very rural area. So it, you know, if they did have a family member come to visit, they had, you know, at least a day's travel time to get to where my grandmother lived up there in the mountains here in East Tennessee.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. And especially in that place, did this person have some kind of an attachment to that house, or do you think that she firmly believed that that this presence of this gentleman was, I correct me again if I'm wrong, was this a brother, an uncle,
an uncle?
Yes. Okay, so why do you suppose he made contact with her? Did she ever try to figure that out?
Really, it was more just a familial thing. You know, I come from a very tight-knit family. And so whenever they would be in the area, they would often travel there and visit. And so she said she never really looked into it as exactly why, other than just familial passing through. And you know, giving their farewells to say that, you know, they he would see her very soon.
Mm-hmm. Now, since she lives in such a, I would say maybe a dense or what lived in such a dense area, wooded, the whole 10 yards, kind of like that little cabin in the wood kind of thing. Mm-hmm. My question to you would be, did she ever talk about anything from a cryptid standpoint, like a Bigfoot or something that lurked around and they were maybe told to stay in the house in the evening time, anything like that? Any stories like that?
She would share several different stories like that. But for her, for the most part, because basically she lived across the field from us in her later years. And so every time when we would be going to go home at night, it was always now, you know, as soon as your feet hit the grass, don't look back. Don't go over to the woods. Go straight home because you never know what might be lurking in the woods out there, especially after dark.
Yeah. I mean, it could be just about anything and people, it just all depends. Now, since you, where you live, are you living in a wooded area type region or what are you living in since you're there?
I am. I've actually just recently moved back to my hometown, which is where the historic Scott County Jail is. And I've been back here, just moved in, remodeled my other grandparents' old farmhouse. And it is a farm completely surrounded by woods with lots of wildlife, lots of really cool and interesting sights and sounds, I guess we can say. But to me, that's always something, you know, I would hear the stories, especially when it comes to cryptids. And each region has their own cryptids that are local to that area. But I never really gave that aspect a whole lot of thought until I really got out and got into some of these areas here in the mountains. And it's like, you know, I can really understand how some of these creatures could exist, because you get back in some of the backcountry and I can absolutely understand how something can go unseen.
Have you ever seen these fairy lights? You know, they're like or glowing orbs that are amongst the trees and stuff like that. Sometimes people report that in these very dense wooded areas. And have you ever explored these woods per se? And have you ever seen any of these fairy lights flitting about?
You know, we do have some lights in the area known as the New River Lights here. There's a lot of different theories as to what they could be. Personally, myself, I haven't seen them, and I hoped maybe to one day be able to. But, you know, it's kind of like the Brown Mountain Lights and some of these other regions that have stories that are native to the area. I've heard a lot of different stories about them here. And in fact, one of Senator Howard Baker, he actually comes from the area that I'm from. And he did write several pages in a local book talking about those New River Lights. So I haven't seen them, but maybe one day.
Mm-hmm. Well, it might actually be a little terrifying too, because we I talk to a lot of people who have seen these lights in various ways and various colors. And of course, we're, you know, everybody's all trying to figure out, was that Bigfoot? Is there a UFO connection? What am I seeing? Is this something of another a portal or another dimension? It just all depends. But I agree with you. I would like to personally just see them once somewhere. Mm-hmm. And then just hopefully they leave me alone or they don't come and attach or follow a person home or anything like that. So here you are, a youngster, very fascinated by stories. And so was I, in your younger years, and you're in the great, great place there where lots of stuff can happen. So then what happened at the point that you left, let's say high school or whatever, what happened then? Did you continue on your journey of this, or tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So really any opportunity that I could get, I ended up for work down in the Southeast Tennessee area around the Chattanooga area. And of course, down in that area, there's a lot of paranormal activity with, you know, the Civil War battlefields. Pretty much all of East Tennessee is originally native land. So there's a lot of stories that relate to the land itself, and then also events that happened in the area. I ended up going into marketing, graphic design, photography, and art. And so as I'm going throughout my career, you know, I enjoy watching the paranormal entertainment shows that were on TV at the time. Also enjoyed still reading everything that I could get my hands on. But it wasn't until I was approached by a gentleman that I worked with. He actually worked in HR, and he saw my background was in photography. And so he ended up reaching out to me and asking if I wouldn't mind looking at some interesting pictures. He didn't tell me what these pictures were going to be about. He just said, I'd like to show you some interesting photos and get your opinion on them. Mm-hmm. So he sends me these photos, and come to find out they're photos from investigations that he and his team had gone on, primarily residential homes. And so he wanted me to look at them and essentially be able to determine what some of these anomalies that were showing up in the pictures were, and really give a logical explanation or debunk what they had captured. And so, of course, as he's sending me these pictures, that causes me to ask a lot of questions. Like, first off, why did you decide to take this particular picture? What are the claims? What are the stories? What kind of camera did you use? What was the weather like? Usually when someone sends me a picture, there's about 15 questions that are going to follow with that. Mm-hmm. And so as I'm looking at these pictures, you know, he starts sending me multiple pictures. And so after looking at these images, he said, you know, how would you feel about coming on an investigation? So I ended up going on an investigation with him and one of the other guys from the team. At this point in time, they had been, I believe, investigating probably 6 or 7 years themselves. So they had already been doing it for quite some time whenever I went on my first investigation. Mm-hmm. And I got to tell you, you know, I'll never forget that first activity that I experienced that I couldn't explain. You know, it's one thing to see it on TV. It's another to be in a room, to be touched, or to start getting intelligent responses or even residual responses to your questions that are being asked. Mm-hmm. And at that point, you know, and these guys on the team, they were fantastic, true professionals, and they ended up giving me a recorder to carry on the investigation. And so after the investigation, they're like, you know, go back, listen to it, write down anything that seems strange or that you know we didn't capture, because I'm a very detailed person. I'm always taking notes. And so I listened to it, and I hear that voice, you know, that we did not hear in the moment. And that feeling I got of just, wow, this is so cool. But yet, oh my gosh, this was something that was, you couldn't see. So it was almost like a mix of adrenaline and kind of a nauseousness, you know?
Right.
And so I ended up reporting back to them, and they invited me on a couple more investigations and then invited me to join the team. And it was just a wonderful learning experience to learn from these guys who had been doing this for a while, to learn different techniques, as well as learning the history of these locations. And we were probably, I guess, investigating at least a couple places a month, primarily residential, but we would always usually hit at least one or two big commercial locations every month to every other month. Mm-hmm. And so got to travel around to some of the most haunted and historic locations with the team. But really, I found that while I was doing that, at the time, in the very beginning, I was the only female on the team. Mm-hmm. And so I did find that if I was out traveling for work, or if I was out on my own, I was doing a lot of urbex or urban exploration and going to a lot of these different locations that were very interesting to look at, but maybe people didn't quite, you know, take the time or the effort to go back and check them out, but they always had these interesting stories. Mm-hmm. And then I was also riding my motorcycle to different investigations that we were doing as a team. Mm-hmm. Maybe if they were closer to where I lived, it'd be like, you know, I'm just going to load up a little backpack, mm-hmm. ride to the investigation. And so through a series of conversations with some friends, it was kind of like, why aren't you documenting your travels through video rather than just doing it, you know, on your social media sites. Because mm-hmm. usually when I would go to these locations, I would take pictures of them, I would post them, and I'd be like, look, here we are at the coke ovens, or here we are at the rat train tunnel system. You know, and people were really asking a lot of questions about the pictures and the stories. So I thought, you know, why not just document it through video, brand myself, and that's essentially how Ghost Biker was born. I went in, I didn't tell anyone what I was doing. I basically just I thought, I want to go film some investigations and kind of bank this up, release it as a series rather than just releasing it with each investigation that I did. And I guess I really didn't know if I was going to release it or not, you mm-hmm. know? So by saying nothing, I wasn't tying myself down. Mm-hmm. And so because it was taking so much time, because I am a solo investigator, I either investigate by myself or investigate with a videographer, because I had all of this time invested with doing Ghost Biker, I didn't feel that I could really give my all to the team by doing their marketing, doing their videography and such. So I ended up stepping away and devoting that and seeing where things went with Ghost Biker. And here we are rolling into season 6.
Yeah, I think it was genius and brilliant. As most know by now, because you've seen the introduction, you know, we've got Miranda here as our biker chick. So it's very, very interesting. And that was a genius move on your part regarding your branding. Now, I have a question regarding when you first started these investigations, because I know I call myself a citizen researcher, which is essentially the same thing. Someone who does things solely. I have my husband. My husband is basically, he's also experiencing things now because he's been so connected with me when I have experiences and stuff. And that's the question that I have for you. So when you start the investigation process and you actually have your very first experience, no matter what that is, it kind of makes you thirst for more. And I know that that's what happened with me, because it's a whole evolvement on how all of a sudden I got kind of sucked right into it. But the thing is, would you consider yourself to be, at least then or by now or not, a sensitive, an empath, a clairaudient, clairsentient, anything along that lines that people usually start to experience when they immerse themselves into something and then all of a sudden try to accept or do accept the experiences they have? How would you classify yourself?
Well, you know, that's a great question. For me, I've never been, you know, psychic or a medium or anything of that nature. I do believe that a lot of us, especially females, I do believe that a lot of us are empathic. A lot of us do have special gifts in one way or another. I am an artist, and so I do believe that, you know, being able to look at a blank canvas in and of itself is its own special gift. But you know, it's one of those things where I think we do experience a lot more than what we realize. And I think we all have a lot of gifts that maybe we don't realize. And once you start to immerse yourself into this world, and because we are spending a lot of time listening, we're spending a lot of time being silent and a lot of time just being, and then really spending a lot of time sitting there trying to plan out and figure out what we're experiencing, I think that does kind of open up a whole new world that maybe we're not really used to, or maybe we're not necessarily open to. For me, I do, and it kind of comes and goes every now and then. I do see things whenever I'm investigating, but I kind of attribute that more to my artistic side mm-hmm. of things. And I have drawn on several investigations, some of the things that I've seen, mm-hmm. but I think it's just kind of the nature of it that we're opening ourselves up and really kind of digging in deep, that it does kind of open that empathic side mm-hmm. or that seeing side that maybe we don't realize is out there.
And one of the things that you brought up, which I can relate to and many people can relate to, people that are highly creative, like you mentioned, I'm also a photographer, I'm also an artist, I'm also things that really continue to develop the right side. I believe it's the right side. I always say the right side is the creative side, the left side's more the logical side, and sometimes they compete with each other. But it seems like those of us who are very attuned or understand our creative side of ourselves seem to be a little bit more open-minded. And I'm not saying that people who are logical-minded are not good at music or writing or poetry or anything like that. I'm just saying that it seems to me that I haven't met somebody yet who is extremely logical, who buys into the aspect of paranormal happenings or extraterrestrial happenings or whatever. They seem to have a very logical way of saying, nah, I don't think so, you know. And I find, I'm sure you've run into that yourself once in a while, that you see something a certain way, but somebody with maybe a little bit more of a logical mind might try to debunk it right in front of you. Have you run into that very often?
Absolutely. And I think that having the two combined, you know, you can see that a lot on some teams, you know, where you have your more logical minded people. Some of them tend to be the more techie people, you know. It's the more solid, the more, you know, this is the way that you arrive at this answer, you know, more concrete, I guess. When you're looking at it from, you know, a creative person, it seems more fluid. Not to say that the more logical person may not be open to it, but it's just more fluid. And it's just the way, I guess, you're kind of looking at things, you know, that it does tend to, I have noticed that people who are more on the, I guess, creative spectrum, tend to look at things a little bit more differently, and that it seems to be that they seem to be more of the ones that have some of the different special gifts, I guess, if you will.
Yeah, and I'm also wondering regarding these gifts, if you feel like you've acquired anything a little bit more along the way, because it's like usually when you start to delve into this stuff, or I mentioned the part about having or bringing home an attachment or having an experience that scares the bejesus out of you that you weren't expecting. Most people would like to know probably, and that will be my next question to you here, is now that you've gone on some investigations and you've been in kind of a variety of situations, has there ever been one particular situation you can think about or think of that really scared you to the point, and I've had them, most of us have had these, where we rethink the idea of what are we doing and whether or not we should just back out of this entirely. Have you had that moment yet?
I wouldn't say that I've had a moment that has scared me to the point to where I would want to back out. I'm generally curious in nature. And I'm also the type of person, when I go to these locations, now, obviously, I have a healthy enough fear where it's like, you know, it's like, you know, you listen to your gut and, okay, I don't need to be doing this. But I also look at it from the point of view, this is why I'm here. I'm going into this location because I want to have an experience. I have questions, or I want to see if this technique will work. But to answer your question, you know, I did this investigation in season one and season two of this house that we called the House on Sunset Hill. And it essentially started out as an investigation of a local legend that evolved into a residential home investigation. So I was investigating the legend that led to investigating a haunted item that was stored in this residential home that nobody was living in. And so as I was investigating that, we started getting a lot of activity inside the home. And it was just enough activity to pique my interest to wonder, is it coming from the home or is it coming from the item? And so when I spoke with the homeowner, I ended up finding out that, and she was an elderly woman. No one had lived in this home for 12 years. They were using it as storage. And mm-hmm. so she ended up informing me of some things that had happened in the late 70s, early 80s that she believed was leading to activity. And she had had activity with her family the whole time she had been living there. So I asked her that night, I said, so I don't have a lot of equipment with me, but can I use the equipment I have to investigate the home? And while we were filming B-roll for this episode, it was episode 2 of season 1, every time we would step away to film, something would happen on the other floor of the house. Right. And it was distracting me to the point that it's like, okay, there's something here. So we conduct a mini investigation and we got just enough activity that I reached out to my good friend, Tiffany, who I like to kind of investigate more of the darker locations with. I totally respect her style of investigation. And I really wanted her opinion. Okay, these are things that I'm experiencing with this item. These are things I'm experiencing in the home. What are your thoughts on this? Is this just me? So she came in, did an investigation. We covered it in season 1. And then I got to come back and do several full scales. Essentially, this location turned into a full year and a half long case study in this home. And the homeowner gave myself, a videographer, a key to be able to go in and investigate at will. And so we were doing all of these different experiments. And in a sense, I would say that I can't definitively say that anything ever followed me home from this location, except I felt like I became very attached mm-hmm. to the location because it became an obsession.
Right.
There were 5 entities that I found that were in this home, and I wanted to go in there every opportunity I could get. I wanted to experiment every chance I got. And it was so wild that this activity, a lot of the time when you go into a location, if you have a camera and you don't want activity, pull the camera out, because a lot of the time everything will calm down.
True.
And so so I thought, you know, this place was different because it's like it thrived on the attention. It thrived on if I was live or if I was doing something. Mm-hmm. I have filmed several lives in this location that were the most active and the most watched lives I've ever done. And it was, people were having activity in their homes. Mm-hmm. The activity was nonstop. And so I was actually able to follow this house from when I first heard about it through a local legend in a book that was totally unrelated to the home, to this house is active, to the homeowner saying, okay, you've been in here for this year and a half. We've found these different things. Well, guess what? I've got family that's wanting to move into this house. We're going to totally remodel it. Can you get rid of it? That's not something I do. You know, I come in, I try to find logical explanations. I try to document activity. So I told her, no, that is not something I can do. However, I did meet a demonologist that I had spoken with. He just happened to be a table mate with me at a convention in Southern Alabama. Mm-hmm. And so I reached out to him. He did watch the live and he did know the story behind everything. And he said, I think you have a legit case here. And so he said, you know, I think I can help you guys. And he came in, he ended up letting me film and document him cleansing the house, which is something they typically don't do. So it was a real honor to be able to show this and for him to have the trust and the faith that I was going to be able to show this and my videographer edit it in a way to where we're showing what's going on, but not revealing all of the rituals and secrets and stuff that they do. And you could actually, the process was a 10-hour process. You could see on our face, because there were 2 spirits in there that just would not leave the property. And so we did highlight that through the end of season 2. And you can see at that point, through the remodel of the house, just how everything just opened up, everything was calm. And to this day, we still keep in contact with the family that's renting the home. And there's you know, they don't have any issues there. So it's like a completely different house.
Mm-hmm.
I would have to say that experience was probably a very defining experience for me, because it really showed me just how easy it is. Maybe we're not attached by the spirits, but maybe we end up being the attachment for some of these locations ourselves, you know, and we're triggered, like we always are trying to trigger spirits, but maybe we're triggered and we're actually the attachment that these locations get. And, you know, it's amazing how it can become all consuming.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just trying to get answers that that's all you think about, you
mm-hmm.
know? So that was probably that moment for me that mm-hmm. was kind of defining as a paranormal investigator
mm-hmm.
that really made me stop and think, maybe I need to reevaluate how attached you get to some of these cases that you're working on. And really since then, as much as I love residentials, I don't really do residentials and stuff anymore for that reason. But I will reach out and get help for people if someone were to reach out to me for that instance.
Let's talk a little bit about this jail that you have. Very interesting that someone I would be talking to would actually co-own or own a jail. So tell us a little bit about how that all came about.
Sure, absolutely. So during my paranormal journey, I've met a lot of amazing people. And so back in 2019, after my first season had come out, my dearest and one of my best friends, Dr. Christy Sumner from Soul Sisters Paranormal, ended up reaching out to me. And she had been watching my show, and come to find out I had been watching the adventures of her and her twin sister there with Soul Sisters Paranormal. And she reached out to congratulate me on my first season. And so we ended up striking up a fast friendship, because I really admired the way they investigate, and it really mirrored my style of investigating, which is really highlighting the history and sharing that narrative. And then, you know, if you get paranormal activity, great, that's just the cherry on top. But getting that story out there is the most important. So we really clicked with that. So we ended up corresponding and meeting over in Hickory, North Carolina, and investigating Henry River Mill Village. And so through this investigation, we ended up planning several different investigations over the couple years. And so when 2020 comes around, and of course the pandemic and everything, I end up leaving corporate America mm-hmm. and essentially changing what I do, working from home and such. And so we got to talking about forming a company. And so we ended up forming the company History, Highways, and Haunts, LLC. And the opportunity arose that I needed to move back to my hometown. And so here in my hometown of Scott County sits the historic Scott County Jail in the middle of the county seat here in Huntsville. And so at that time, the jail had closed down back in 2008, and it had sat vacant from 2008 up until 2021, whenever Christy and I ended up approaching the town. And basically, we talked about it and knew that we wanted to open it more than just a paranormal research center. So there's so much history here with this building that it's we knew that we could open a true crime museum and really make it accessible to the community. So we approached the town of Huntsville and did a presentation, because paranormal tourism is something that is extremely huge right now,
right,
especially after the pandemic. So we approached the town of Huntsville with a three-phase plan and of wanting to open it during the day as a paranormal during the day as a true crime museum, and then in the evenings as a paranormal research center, opening it up to just the paranormal or the ghost enthusiast, for the ones that like to do a flashlight tour so that they get that dose of history, but mm-hmm. then also a slight, maybe have a paranormal experience, to the more immersive guided ghost hunt experience where they could come in and investigate with myself and Dr. Sumner, or to the paranormal team where they can come in and conduct paranormal research overnight. And so the town was, they were all about it. And so after being closed from 2008 to 2021, we came in, we opened up the museum. And to this date, we've been open about a year and a half now. And we've had over 100 teams that have come in, spent the night, and captured some really cool evidence here. We also just recently ended up expanding. So about 20 miles from here is the utopian village of Rugby, Tennessee, which was founded by British author Thomas Hughes. And so this community had been in existence since the 19th. Well, it was originally built in 1880, but it's been on the historic registry there as a historic landmark since the 1970s. And so they've been functioning as this wonderful little lodging community that has all kinds of daytime events and then some really cool events at Halloween in the evenings. But we approached them about a year ago and we were like, look, you know, ghost tours and after dark walks and paranormal investigations are something that you should really consider. And we took them on a tour of the jail, showed them what we've done here with the jail, and they were just instantly on board and excited about it. And so we've since expanded and offer after dark tours and investigations there in Rugby. So it's honestly a dream come true to be able to take this that's always been an interest in my life and really a part of my life with the storytelling and from my family side, to be able to actually do this as a job and open this up, sharing these stories and helping this history live on to other folks in the community and around the world, hearing these stories that come from my hometown.
And right now you are currently in this jail, right?
Yes. Yes.
And have you figured out at all through, since you've had a number of teams in there, have you identified and figured out who apparition wise is still hanging about there?
We do know several of our resident spirits, and I feel we're able to really conduct some true paranormal research because between myself and my business partner, we're in here up to 16 hours a day. Huh. And so you really start to learn the way some of these spirits communicate, whether it be intelligently or residually. And so we do know several spirits that are here. One is Sheriff Richard Ellis, or he goes by R.D. Ellis. He was killed right outside the front door, which is essentially just right over a few feet from me. He was bringing in a moonshiner. He was shot from behind, ambush style. And so we have seen his spirit here. We've captured some really compelling photos. Sheriff Ellis was a unique individual. He was a Baptist preacher, and he was between 6'7" and 6'8".
Oh my gosh.
Yes. And so one of the shadow figures that we do see here quite often is an extremely tall, between 6'8" and 7-foot shadow figure. Interestingly enough, we've captured it over in our drunk tank area. Mm-hmm. And it really makes a lot of sense to me because Sheriff Ellis ran under the stance that he was going to make Scott County as dry as the Sahara. So this was back in the 20s. And by doing that, because moonshine was something that was so prevalent and such a big moneymaker in the area, he put a target on his back. And they did tell him that if he did do that, that he wouldn't make it through his term. And they made good of that. So they do believe that one of the moonshiners did that. It is still an unsolved mystery, but he is one of the individuals that we do get a lot of activity on all three floors of the jail. The other, we do believe that the energy of Jerome Boyett, he was one of the inmates that was in here that was taken out via Mob Mountain Justice. We've had 7 different inmates that we know of. We believe that there was more, but 7 that we've been able to document that were taken out of here during different times via Mob Mountain Justice, basically masked mobs of individuals that wanted to take the law into their own hands, busted into the jail and took some of these inmates out. and lynched or murdered them on different areas on the property. And Jerome Boyett was lynched or murdered back in 1933 with his cellmate Harvey Winchester. And so we actually just had the 90-year anniversary of that tragic event last week. And so we do get activity from him up on the third floor. There's several spirits that tend to, it doesn't matter the floor, they tend to want to travel. But up on the third floor, which is maximum security, we have several inmates. Big Roy is one of them, that he tends to kind of stay in his cell, but we know that he likes the women and he also likes to be kind of challenging to some men. So you can almost kind of tell when some people come in what their personality is like. If there's somebody that's like, spend a little time over there with Big Roy, you're probably going to bring out activity. So we're constantly learning, especially when mediums and psychics come in. They're able to help us fill in some of the gaps. Mm-hmm. Also, some of our paranormal investigators that don't have special abilities or spiritual gifts, they've been able to actually get evidence that we've been able to go back and confirm and validate through some of our historical research. Mm-hmm. And they've gotten these captures off of spirit boxes or different word banks. Mm-hmm. The entities that are here in this jail, for the most part, with the exception of your residual activity, are very intelligent, they're very aware, and they really want to share their story. And I think it's the approach that myself and my business partner have, as well as the way a lot of the teams come in, that we're really wanting to share their story, and they want to tell it. You know, we've had people come in that have been very pleasantly surprised and excited, and it's quickly becoming one of their favorite places because the activity has been so different and so intelligent in nature that we get a lot of, as we call them, repeat offenders coming back trying to fill in gaps of their stories based on the previous investigations that they've had.
So do you ever feel nervous or afraid being there? Like most people aren't aware that right now Miranda and I are practically doing a midnight interview here. And, you know, when does the activity rev up the most? Anytime or during the midnight hours? Or what do you see there happening?
It varies. We get a lot of activity during the day. We also get some at night. You know, with a lot of the residual, obviously, this jail was active both day and night when it was in operation, just different types of activity. So you will see that throughout the day. It won't be uncommon to sit here and hear doors slam and everything. Apparently, the flashlight tour that was had earlier this evening was pretty active up on the third floor area, and that would have been around the 9-10 o'clock hour. We do get some of the most incredible footsteps that I've ever heard from anywhere. And we've been able to kind of pinpoint the timing that this happens. It tends to happen between 10 till and the top of the hour at random times throughout the night. Now, that's not to say sometimes in the evening when you're up there, you will hear that. But we do believe that that was probably a jailer that as he was going and doing his rounds around the jailer's walk. Mm-hmm. But we've noticed it just depends. One of the things that personally myself that I've noticed, it doesn't seem to be a moon phase that mm-hmm. affects it as much as it is the weather. When we have storms and rain,
right,
it absolutely charges things up here.
Right. Right.
It doesn't really seem to, I mean, again, dates and stuff can be kind of significant. When we were investigating on the anniversary of the Jerome Boyett lynchings, we did have some pretty wild activity, but it doesn't seem to be as much moon phase as it does weather related, at least from what I've personally noticed.
So have you gone up on, it seems like the third floor is relatively active up there. How many cells are up there in that jail of yours?
So right now on the third floor. And of course, one thing to understand is, so the jail was in operation from 1904 until 2008. And so during its time, the structure has kind of changed a little bit. you know, this first floor that we're on, up until the 1960s, this was the jailer's quarters. Okay. This area here would have been the living room that I'm sitting in. And then, of course, after they quit living here, they did kind of change and shift things around. The second floor is the trustee floor. The third floor is maximum security. And so on the third floor, there are three cell blocks up there, and there are three, four, five, six, seven. So there's seven cells within those three cell blocks. Some of them held four inmates, some held three, two. We do have the administrative segregation where they would segregate you off up there. And then there's a big mass communal cell that housed the women in that area. And it was supposed to hold around five, but with most county jails, especially here in the South, we did suffer from overcrowding throughout the time the jail was in operation. So it held 50 inmates to one jailer, but it would not be uncommon to hold up to 100 inmates at various times. Anywhere they could throw a cot down and lock a door, they would do that. We've even had reports of them turning inmates away. Like if you came in drunk and disorderly, they would let you sober up, because if they didn't have a uniform and they didn't have anywhere to put you, they would let them go sometimes. So really, the activity shifts. Mm-hmm. You know, every now and then we'll get a lot of reports from investigators and ourselves that the third floor is just off the chain active. Mm-hmm. But then you'll hear down here at the drunk tank area that there's, and we've not really been able to correlate that. Is it a specific event or what? Or is it just some type of shift? Mm-hmm. But it seems like the second and third floors specifically. Second floor is by far the creepiest. The third floor is, and I don't know if it's because it's a trustee area and it's more dorm style cells, and you're kind of going into this darker area, but we've had everything from pictures being thrown off the walls. Teams have actually captured, one in particular captured a picture getting pulled off the wall, and you actually see a shadow arm come out, and they throw the picture 4.5 feet. It actually flips in midair. And we've been able to freeze the screen on right. this arm. So, and then of course the footsteps, the apparitions that are seen. It really just depends. And we've not been able to pinpoint why it shifts the way it does, but you will kind of notice that if you have a team come in one week, they'll talk about the activity, and you'll kind of start to notice that they're saying, we didn't get much on these areas, but this area we did. And it'll go like that for a little while, and then it just seems like there's a shift, and then it'll go like that for a little while and then change again.
So the thing with the picture on the wall, is it, do you think that there's a theory behind why they flipped it off the wall, or just it was just a random picture and they just tossed it in the air to just let people know that something was there and they wanted to get your attention? What do you think?
So personally, I believe, so it was a night where there were two investigators here. The two investigators had a background in corrections. Mm-hmm. So they were using that as kind of triggering. But they were up on the second floor. They heard what a lot of people tend to hear, which is a female say help. Mm-hmm. All of their tools started going crazy. And so then they grabbed their camera and looked out in the hall. It just so happens the picture that was pulled off the wall is a resignation letter of one of our former sheriffs that we had here. He was sheriff from 1976 until 1986 when he was arrested by the FBI for getting involved with the Mexican drug cartel.
Interesting.
And so, yes. And so we wonder, or myself personally, I wonder if it has something to do with, so this particular sheriff, he spent a lot of time here in this jail, not only as sheriff, but also as deputy in years prior. He also had a family history that his family worked here. Mm-hmm. And so he was very connected with it, very connected with his job. So it was something that really pained him to have to write this resignation letter. And I know he really felt like he had let the community down by getting involved. Mm-hmm. And so personally, I wonder if it could have to be, could have to do with him. And then also the fact that, that these gentlemen were corrections officers when they were, or had a background in that when they were here. I think it could be related for that nature.
And I know even as a college teacher, when my classroom became relatively haunted, I mean, there are all kinds of things happening mm-hmm. in there, from students getting whispers in their ears to machinery malfunctioning that never malfunctioned before. You just know what yes. is paranormal, and you just know what is logically something else. And that's what's very fascinating about where you are and the types of experiences that you're going through or the others go through. Personally, I don't know how you do it. I'd be creeped out just even be sitting in there right now. I presume you lock up and go home, right? You don't actually live there. Is that correct?
That's correct. And just to kind of jump back on that, what you were saying for a second, we tried to, so the guys came and got me after this happened, and we tried for about 30 minutes to try to debunk it. Mm-hmm. And when you watch the video of it, multiple things happen, from hearing that disembodied voice to the equipment going off. And on the camera, before they capture the arm, there's a shadow that appears on the side of the screen, and then a light anomaly that comes down just as the picture is falling. And so we tried to debunk that. There was no way we could get that picture to do anything except fall straight down. Even with exerting force on it, we could not get it to flip in midair. Even my business partner came in the next day, and she was even trying things like opening the doors to make sure there was no suction. We tested this so much, we actually ended up breaking the frame from dropping it so much. Mm-hmm. And so then to kind of tie on to the second part of your question with, you know, being nervous and stuff about being here, it definitely has its moments at night. It takes on, especially now, you know, getting close to midnight, it does take on, it's a whole other persona at night. You know, it's not uncommon to sit here, hear doors slam, hear people walking upstairs. People have seen things while I've been doing my podcasts and stuff here, or while my business partner has been a guest on podcasts. People will see things. There have been moments that we have gotten kind of freaked out a little bit. Mm-hmm. And sometimes whenever you go home, you know, you're immersed in this every day. It's sometimes you see and hear things. It's a little bit harder to not see and hear when you go to lay down at night. Mm-hmm. It is a totally different experience going from an investigator to being a location owner and being immersed in it every day, really, you know.
As we wrap up here, I want you to tell everybody how they can reach out to you, come visit you at the jail, how they can get a hold of you or see anything that you have on YouTube or wherever. What kind of information would you like to share with everyone tonight?
Absolutely. So again, I just want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to come on and share my story. And I also want to say, yes, that was Sally. She is our jail cat, and she does live here at the jail. People can come and see her. She is the true owner of the jail. Yeah. But yes, people can go and they can watch all the past seasons of Ghost Biker Explorations by checking out the Ghost Biker Explorations Facebook page, Ghost Biker Explorations YouTube channel, and www.ghostbikerexplorations.com. Watch all of those past episodes. Get ready for season 6, or watch season 6. You can do that. All of my new seasons come out every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern time during the month of October, followed by a Behind the Screams episode that is live, that talks about the episode, the tools, and really breaks things down. They can also watch my weekly live stream called Shop Talk Live from the Ghost Biker Garage, where I have authors, artists, podcasters, investigators, location owners coming on sharing their stories as well. They can follow my photography and my journey on Instagram under Runaway Vixen. Or if you're interested in the historic Scott County Jail or historic Rugby After Dark, you can follow those pages by going to www.historicscottcojail.com or looking us up on Facebook under Historic Scott County Jail or Historic Rugby After Dark. Our company's page is historyhighwayshaunts.com. And on that page, we have a link to both the jail website as well as the Historic Rugby After Dark page. If you want to find more information, take one of our tours, whether it be for true crime or for our After Dark activities.
Mm-hmm. Real good. And I'm going to have all this information on the show notes at the end on both podcast, of course, and TV segment here. So, Miranda, on behalf of the show, thank you so very much for being on the show today.